Welcome to the Fourth Watch Podcast, a curated conversation with some of the most interesting voices in the media. I'm Steve Krakauer. Today, the editor of the relaunched Gawker, Leah Finnegan, is here. This is episode 31. On relaunching Gawker, working for Nick Denton and now Brian Goldberg, being nice on the internet today, the Hogan verdict and Peter Thiel, we start with the state of digital journalism in America as we begin 2022. I wanted to, in researching for our interview here, we'll go back. I remembered my favorite thing you had ever written, which was in July of 2015, which I went back and read. And actually, it's even more like, you were like seeing the future even more, I think, than the relevance of it at the time. But you wrote an article for Gawker called "The Journalists of the Future Are Thirsty Motherfuckers." And it was about Mike Fusion and Ozzy. And you quote, you include some quotes from Alexis Madrigal, who was running Fusion at the time, which is talking about building an institution that is suspicious of institutions that our parents and grandparents built, which are mostly failing us anyway, interested in equality and social justice. And you describe it, you say, why do millennials need their own news sites? They can't read the big kid papers. Are the fonts too small? Not enough Rihanna content. I don't need to read the whole article, but people can go back and read it. But it's funny now, you know, now that we are in 2022, Ozzy, we know what happened to Ozzy. That's a disaster. Fusion is completely gone. Mike, I won't ask you to comment on, but which has died and come back and is now sort of your sister site over at Gawker under the umbrella there. But what do you look at as you look across the spectrum in the media space? Where has the sort of digital media space evolved from when you wrote that in 2015?
I think I would say it's devolved, killing those sites. You know, there's been kind of a Darwinistic bent to media, and that at first it was, you know, all the old newspapers dying off, and now it's all the new websites that never really lived up to their missions, which were ridiculous to begin with.
Right. Yeah. I know. I mean, the Fusion's an interesting one because, you know, some of them like Ozzy, I mean, it did eventually, as we know now, and the stories that have come out over the last year, thanks to Ben Smith and others, you know, blew through a lot of like venture capital. But Fusion was like, I mean, every other week there was someone who was, you know, announcing their job at Fusion, and they hired a bunch of really great people, lasted for a very short amount of time. It does seem like this great case study in that moment in media. But I don't know how much has changed. You know, I don't know how much is different now from the types of content or the types of, you know, the goals of certain media outlets to what it was then. And in fact, I would say, you know, certain larger media outlets could say the same things that they're trying to do with, you know, trying to reach a new audience as these smaller sites were at the time.
Do you think like the larger newspapers are trying to become younger? This is actually something I was thinking about before this podcast, because I was like, what if he asked me the thing I like the least about media now? And I was going to say big MSM papers covering teens.
Yeah.
In an effort to seem younger. I don't know if that answers your question at all.
Yeah, no. Well, there definitely is some of that. But I guess, you know, I don't know if you would include this in things you don't like about the media today. But I do look at that. I mean, when you wrote that July 2015, that was just around the time that Donald Trump came down the escalator and announced that he was running for president. And it sort of upended the entire media landscape. And I want to talk about your exit from Gawker, your return to Gawker, what Gawker is now, what Gawker was then, and also we'll touch on my criticisms of Gawker at some point. But I think, like, you know, that did really change media, and it has for the last 4 or 5 years, and it may again if he runs again. How much do you think of the, you know, the sun in the media landscape that everything orbits around being Donald Trump has had to do with where it's evolved over the last few years?
I mean, so much. I think another thing that became really popular during Donald Trump was kind of acting in bad faith. And that's been huge in kind of fueling the ecosystem, like going to Twitter, making people mad, then people respond. And then it's just kind of an endless cycle. And Trump doing kind of the same things over and over in a different voice just kept that going and going and going in a Groundhog Day sort of way. So it was, you know, it was a parasitic relationship, but also really good for CNN and the Post and the Times. And I don't think as much for websites, because obviously the first iteration of Gawker, when it pivoted to politics only, it changed a lot and kind of, I would argue, lost a lot of its DNA.
When it started doing politics more than like kind of the New York media scene and
Yeah.
How did the focus on Donald Trump change the media over the past 5 years? And what does it mean to be a, quote, nicer Gawker? It seems like every website that, you know, existed in some purpose became a website about Trump on some level during the last 4 years. And you know, part of that, I think, was a business decision. Maybe part of that was personal. And, you know, we've come out of that. Some people, I think some media outlets have chosen to remain in that. And others have had to kind of figure out what else to do. And some, you know, not so successfully, but I guess you, when you relaunched Gawker, it was in a, you know, at least temporarily post-Trump world.
Yes. Thank God. I ran the outline, which got shut down at the beginning of the pandemic. Yeah. You know, it launched in December, 2016. So was it 2016? Yeah. And it was just such an impossible time to have a website start, because it was like, we're trying not to be super political, and yet this is all anyone's talking about. So it's just kind of like a quandary, like how do we be a website apart from Trump when that's the only thing that people are paying attention to?
Right.
And towards the end, I was just like, we're not gonna cover Trump. Like, that's not our lane. We don't really have anything new to say. You know, it's just tiring to react to this stuff. And ultimately, no one wants to read it from a boutique website.
Well, that's the thing. I know you've talked about the outline and sort of the goal of it, and being, you know, boutique website or a niche, and it is, you know, there was nuance there that a lot of the Trump era didn't necessarily allow for. It was either, you know, go hard one way or the other, and you know, there wasn't much room to, like, you know, any pivot away from something felt like, you know, at least to some people, and I would say like the Twitter crowd, like it wasn't catering to what was the you know, all caps, most important thing of the moment. I interviewed Elizabeth Spires for this podcast right around the time that they announced that the new Gawker, I guess the second iteration of the new Gawker, was coming, and you were joining. And I think we both were you know, had high hopes for it, I would say, based on who was being hired. But there was always the question of, like, Gawker was sort of the counterculture, and you know, the, you know, how would it be able to stay countercultural when, you know, late night shows and SNL, which was, you know, we're all sort of culture or counterculture, you know, became just like the establishment, you know, in this Trump era, and were used in this way. So is that something that you thought about when you were sort of, you know, building your team and thinking about it, of like, how does this live now in this new environment?
For sure. And, you know, when the website was sued into oblivion by Peter Thiel, it became clear that if it were to exist again, it really needed to consider the direction it was going to go in. Because, of course, it became too big for itself. It was no longer punching up. It was punching down. And that's, you know, what got it into a lot of hot water a lot of the time. So I knew it wasn't going to be able to go back from that. So my first instinct was like, okay, let's make Gawker funny. Like that was my favorite post at Gawker were funny. And yeah. I laughed so much reading it and I laughed so much writing it. So like not even the Onion is funny anymore because it got poisoned by Trump. So I'm like, I want to do a non like political funny website that just makes fun of pop culture. There's so much celebrity worship, which I can't stand. So I want to make fun of celebrities, just poking fun at culture and offering like really smart cultural criticism. So that was in my mind the direction I wanted the site to go in, just to kind of be an outlet for people who weren't, you know, just bowing down to culture as it stood.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I would say that you've sort of eased into that as we're talking shortly after Christmas. People are still very up in arms over the Rest in Power White Ladies article that was out there.
Yeah, I think this was our first cancellation. So we made it like 6 months. I'm really impressed.
Yeah, no, this is good. I mean, it, you know, you could say, I guess the Robert F. Kennedy Jr., you know, was a cancellation, but that was more from the anti-vaxxers. This was more from the mainstream.
I didn't see any. I only saw, you know, unfettered praise for that.
No, I'm joking.
I searched Gawker unfettered praise on Twitter every day.
So. And you found that. Okay. Yeah, well, the Twitter loved it. I enjoyed it also. And I enjoyed the other one also. I mean, that's the thing. That's also what I feel like where we're in right now, where people have gotten very sensitive, I would say, on both sides of the aisle in a lot of ways. And so the kinds of things like that, you know, piece, you know, the White Ladies and Joan Didion, like, you know, the thought that you would potentially, and I don't really care either way, but it was like the fact that people might have been offended that the thing that they felt very strongly about, they were being laughed at was, yeah, I mean, it was hard for people to accept that. And that does feel, I mean, Gawker pissed people off back in the old days, but it was a different kind of, it was not the overly sensitive Twitter crowd that was getting pissed off because they were being laughed at. People had like a little bit of a thicker skin, or maybe just like were able to laugh at themselves a little bit more than maybe they can in as we enter 2022.
I think so. And I think people forget like Gawker used to get, I remember right when I started, there was a controversy because there was some post that like brought up the concept of Korean comfort women, and they like used that in a headline. And, you know, this was before Twitter was super big, but I just remember starting and that was the fire that was being put out. And I was like, what have I gotten myself into? Like, this is beyond anything I've ever experienced. Like, who would put that in a headline? And how do you, you know, kind of like extinguish that fire?
Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, I think that your background, I mean, coming from HuffPost, from the New York Times, when I ask you about the New York Times also, it was obviously, it's a different ethos than Gawker. But I was curious about your take on some of the things, because, you know, Ben Smith wrote the piece about the new Gawker, and the headline was, if Gawker is nice, is it still Gawker? And then, you know, later there were other people saying it's, well, Gawker is not about, you know, being nice now. This idea of Gawker and nice actually, I think, harkens back a little bit to a piece that was written, I feel like was written by Nick Denton at one point about being 10% nicer, or maybe I'm getting the confusion about who made that. So everything about, is Gawker nice, or what percentage nice is Gawker? I think that's like people really have a strong affiliation with that. But in the Ben Smith article in the New York Times, you talk about how you were a terrorist and now you're not interested in ruining people's lives. And I know you've had some like self-reflective pieces in the outline that you wrote, but I mean, how much are you conscious of that? Like in what you're doing now with Gawker, is it really about like actively not trying to do something that you think was part of the DNA of Gawker before?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot about the Justine Sacco post, which was this, you know, became this famous thing where a blogger found a tweet from a random like PR rep at the Daily Beast that said, I'm flying to Africa, like hope I don't get AIDS, and just posted that and was like, here's a comment from the Daily Beast PR person. And the woman, of course, was flying to Africa. She was out of pocket for 12 hours and she landed and everyone, like all of Twitter was about her. And it ruined her life. Like she got fired. She was, you know, became a pariah. She was fully and roundly canceled before that was even kind of in the lexicon. And, you know, she was just some rando with like 500 Twitter followers. And it became like this interesting self-reflective thing where the blogger actually met with her and, you know, they talked about her cancellation and how it affected her and like changed her life, and they came to peace, and you know, he apologized, and it was kind of this really beautiful thing, but it was destructive to her. And she's not a public figure. She did a bad tweet. We all do it. I mean, hers was particularly bad, but did she deserve to be on Gawker for that? No, like not even then, when they were like even more vicious than we are now. So that's kind of my ethos. Like, I'm like, you know, no going for people who have fewer than like 50,000 Twitter followers. Like someone has to be above the threshold of like public identity.
All right. So I've got a little under, so that's good. That's how I feel in good shape. No, but like, it hasn't gone away. I will say Justin Sacco, that story is in, so you've been publicly shamed. People will learn more. It's an interesting case, very early on in the cancel culture, but even like, you know, Amy Cooper, as an example, you know, the Central Park Karen, you know, could be sort of an example of that now, which was not from Gawker necessarily, but you could make an argument was more from the mainstream publications like the New York Times that pushed that story. And a little bit of a different circumstance. I mean, it's not a bad tweet. It's a bad experience that, you know, maybe was a lot more nuanced than people gave it credit for. But her life was effectively ruined also. I mean, she's now in, you know, in isolation somewhere, apparently.
And wasn't that, that was just, you know, Christian Cooper.
Yeah.
Who filmed her in the park and then tweeted it. So it's not even like the publications are doing this to people. It's just people are, it's being distributed like through citizen journalism, like, not that these acts aren't right or wrong, but they're coming out just via social channels where people can make of them what they want.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, and I would say, you know, that talk about like Christian Cooper was not someone who was necessarily a public figure either.
Right.
But there's an amplification, you know, mechanism now with Twitter where a person that has a couple hundred or a couple thousand followers can put something out there. And then it gets picked up by the large accounts. And I don't remember exactly which ones were the ones that originally amplified. I know Soledad O'Brien was one who's got over 1 million followers. So people can then turn that into a thing where you might not even really mean for it to become a big thing.
Right.
And all of a sudden it does. So.
Right. And, you know, Justine Sacco would have been just signal boosted by Twitter. Like she wouldn't have even needed Gawker to cancel her.
Yeah. I mean, if that happened today, it would be right. It would have been even bigger, I would say. Coming up, we break down the last time Leah left Gawker over the fallout from a piece outing a media executive. What does she think of that saga 5 years later? That's next. But first, the Omicron variant is becoming the reality variant in the media, but we're still not getting it exactly right. One residual benefit of a lot of media members in New York City and DC getting COVID right now is they're starting to see the truth. These are mostly young, mostly healthy people, and they likely have been vaxxed and boosted, and they're taking all sorts of COVID precautions, and yet here they are stuck in quarantine. They're not getting very sick. That's a good thing. Thankfully, Omicron is proving to be a very contagious but far more mild version of COVID. But the Omicron variant is also simultaneously becoming the reality variant, forcing many in the press to take a second look at the cost-benefit analysis of all elements of this pandemic and actually get real about what we're facing, sort of. But let's look at the good first. There's the situation with masks, the kinds that most people wear, and CNN contributor Dr. Lena Wen going even further than she has in the past by stating definitively that cloth masks are not appropriate for this pandemic. Then there's the question about what to do when you have a positive test. The CDC changed their guidance to reduce the quarantine time from 10 days to 5 days, prompting outrage for the sweeping unscientific decree from a variety of people. But the key point, why isn't testing part of the equation? Well, we know why. It's because the administration never ramped up testing, and tests are hard to find. But at least the media and the administration are thinking more critically and clearly about the effort to reduce the focus on cases. It did lead to an incredible tweet by Jennifer Rubin of the Washington Post, who wrote, "As we recognize that COVID-19 is not a deadly or even severe disease for the vast majority of responsible Americans, we can stop agonizing over cases and focus on those who are hospitalized or at risk of dying." Quite a different tune when cases were rising in Florida and Jen was tweeting much differently. We're starting to think critically about vaccines too. The New York Post reports on scientists who, quote, warn that too many shots might actually harm the body's ability to fight the COVID-19 virus as Israel prepares fourth doses. This, by the way, as vaccine mandates for air travel are being floated, and Dr. Fauci is saying on ABC over the weekend that anything that could get people more vaccinated would be welcome, with no pushback from John Carl. Quote, anything? Fauci did have to walk that back in subsequent media interviews when more skeptical press gave him a challenge. But it's not enough. There were recently a run of stories about how pediatric hospitalizations are on the rise with Omicron, including a, quote, five-fold increase in New York City alone that was picked up everywhere from CBS News to CNN. But the total number at the time of pediatric hospitalizations in New York City after that five-fold increase is 109, up from 22. Meanwhile, New York City is seeing tens of thousands of cases per day, and the stats we do have for pediatric hospitalizations, note, by the way, that pediatric refers in most states to people 0 through 19, show a less than 1% hospitalization rate. The death rate remains effectively zero, and of course, there are tons more Omicron cases, so it makes sense that there will be some more hospitalizations because of it. Kids could be going to the hospital for lots of reasons and finding out they have Omicron there. And yes, as the New York Times reported, preliminary data suggests that compared with the Delta variant, Omicron appears to be causing milder illness in children, similar to early findings for adults. A side effect of this current wave of the media variant is we'll get some more realistic COVID coverage. That's a good thing. But we have a long way to go. More with Leah coming up, but first, the Fourth Watch podcast is presented by The First TV. The First is a new network for free speech and big ideas featuring Bill O'Reilly, Dana Lash, Buck Sexton, and more. It's a forum for new thought, new approaches, and an enlightening voice for a new America that embraces the founding principles and ideals that form the greatest country on the planet. The First is free. Free speech, free ideas, free TV. You watch The First TV on Pluto TV, Distro TV, Apple TV, The First TV app, and more. Go to thefirsttv.com to learn more. Now, back to Leah Finnegan.
It actually kind of brings up to the whole reason you left Gawker originally, which was another story about, I think I would say, and I want to get into it, but a little bit more, there's a little bit more to it than a bad tweet. Let's just say that. This was about a Condé Nast executive who, the article that was written was about him paying for a gay escort. He also, you know, again, people can look up this whole thing, but he also was the brother of a very famous Obama administration official who maybe wasn't so popular with people in the newsroom, let's just say. And it eventually was taken down. And I want to talk about that aspect of it. But in researching this, he actually, his life, I mean, it was a very bad experience for him in the moment, but his life was actually ruined, really. I mean, he seems to be doing just fine currently based on his current LinkedIn. Looking back at that story, before we get into like the whole drama that ensued after internally and externally, what do you think about that piece looking back on it?
Terrible. This had no justification for existing.
Really? So you, okay. So would you, do you agree with the decision now to take it down?
No.
Okay. Because that's obviously the whole thing. I mean, even the people that were outraged about it taken, you know, being taken down, or even, you know, that they didn't necessarily think the piece was like perfect. And I know you said that even, you know, shortly after you left, but the big issue was it being taken down, and I guess the way it was taken down, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm a purist in that sense where I don't think anything should be taken down ever and should just, you know, needs to be a part of the record so people can see this story and they can, you know, be like, oh yeah, that's bad. Like, that's like a framework of what not to do. And I'm glad it's still there to show what Gawker became at that moment in time. And this is like an instructive piece, because you can't, I mean, you can't look at it anymore. So you don't know, there's no record of what it was. I mean, it's probably on the archive, but.
It's, I don't know. No, I don't think you can find it. I mean, you obviously can find a lot of things about it. But I couldn't find a lot of things. Like I couldn't find, there was a like Kinja posts that I couldn't find when I was trying to do this. So I feel like a lot of the old stuff is not able to be reached.
The SEO really got trashed in the lawsuit. And because the site was more or less dormant for however many years. So right. Yeah, it really, it's unfortunate that it got so crippled, but I guess you can blame Peter Thiel for that too.
Blame Peter Thiel for a lot. We'll talk about Peter Thiel. So the fallout from that piece then being taken down by Nick Denton and the essentially the executives, not the editors, caused the editors of Gawker to resign. Union put out a statement. You live tweeted that meeting. In which, you know, I think it's fair to say you got in a fight with Nick in that moment, took a buyout shortly late, after that. I know you said you sort of regretted that in a post that you wrote, but, you know, the whole idea of like a live tweeted internal, like heated meeting, we've seen that a couple times since, like in the years since. And I wonder like what you think of the way that that became such a public thing and obviously your role in that.
Well, that was the whole ethos of Gawker, which is what confused me about why Nick got so mad. But it does prove that he is a human and has limits, which is kind of nice to see.
like transparency,
The whole radical transparency. And, you know, there was just so much pressure. It was a tinderbox for, you know, competition and who will get the most traffic and who can do the most provocative thing and who can set off the biggest firestorm. So, except when it ultimately came down to making fun of Nick Denton. But it was a very emotional time for everyone. And I was not as concerned for my job security as I might be in this present day.
Yeah, when I talked to Elizabeth Spires, she said, you know, one of the things that Gawker had for a long time was an owner who would tolerate the backlash. And that was somewhat a rare occurrence in the media space at the time. I would say certainly now. Now you've got Brian Goldberg, who's the owner of Gawker. Do you feel like you've got that, an owner who's going to tolerate the backlash when it does come?
We'll see. I think so far he's been very tolerant and, you know, he will absolutely express to me when he doesn't agree with an article. And I listen and we move on, but you know, we'll see. It's an interesting dance. And I think I've done this enough with, CEOs in my life where you're like, okay, I want to keep this website alive, but I also want to be Gawker and I want to have a website that is actually good.
Right. Yeah. It's a dance. And that's the thing. I mean, if Gawker is the site that people go to find things that are not at other places, you're mm-hmm. going to have a buy-in by, I guess, on some level management to do things that are not just what everyone else is doing. And that's, you know, can feel, I would imagine for people that, you know, a little bit risky and a little uncomfortable, but I guess that's sort of the point also. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about the New York Times, sure. Because you will not, I don't think, enjoy this comparison, but it reminded me a little bit of like when you were live tweeting that meeting, there was the Tom Cotton op-ed fallout. Barry Weiss live tweeted that internal meeting, got a lot of shit from others, you know, both internally, like her colleagues there and outside. She ended up then leaving, starting something new. I'm not comparing necessarily you and Barry Weiss, but I'm curious what you think of like that moment in time. This was last year, or I guess year and a half ago, maybe. And where the New York Times is now
versus even when you were there?
I mean, I thought that was so unconscionable, just the crazy. And it illustrated to me how the Times has kind of become, or in that moment was kind of Gawkery, where it was like, let's do the craziest opinion we can to make like the libs mad. And it's written by a senator, so it's okay. And I just thought it was so out of line and unnecessary. And it didn't surprise me that it wasn't read by like the highest in charge. But what I liked about the Times when I was there was that the opinion section was so austere and just like very traditional, but intellectual in its way, in a sense that it isn't really anymore.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, the piece for those who don't remember, it was headlined "Send in the Troops" by Tom Cotton. This was in the height of the George Floyd social justice protests. I will say the column itself was a lot less incendiary than the headline, but no, you're right. I mean, the editor, you know, James Bennett ended up leaving because he was not necessarily directly involved in the editing process.
Yes.
But there were also calls. I mean, there was the whole push that this is endangering the lives of New York Times staffers, which felt a little bit over the top. And there were calls to take it down. There did seem like a little bit of parallels, I would say, regardless of whether you agreed with the piece or not.
I mean, if they had outed Tom Cotton,
they outed him as really a they outed him as a pro military takeover guy. The different sort of
I don't think that's a proper outing in the Gawker sense, but yeah, that was wild. It was wild. It's wild to see, you know, how the page has changed in the short 7 odd years since I left.
What was the reason that you felt you had to leave? What was it? You know, what was happening there that you were like, this is not for me?
From the Times?
Yeah.
Well, I was fired from the Times. So that's, you know, a theme in my work history is being fired for some kind of insubordination.
Okay.
It was a complicated situation, but it had to do with the fact that I was working on an opinion app that was, fated for failure. And I was also, I had won a fellowship to go to Auschwitz and they wanted me to cancel the fellowship. And I said, no. And then they were like, well, since you didn't cancel it, you're fired. It was very confusing, but it led to me going to Gawker, which didn't always yield any reasonable coverage of the Times. I remember one of the first pieces I wrote was Frank Bruni is the worst columnist at the New York Times, which I truly believe, but also he was the maybe the meanest columnist to the news assistants, of which I was one for a couple of years.
So that was like it was a response to that personal experience that you had.
Yeah, it's like, finally, I have my platform to rail against Frank Bruni. untold power.
Well, that worked out. I mean, it was a good match then, to do so at Gawker. I would say fit in at Gawker, I would imagine.
Yeah, right. I was really happy to write about the media there, which was super fun.
Yeah. Because of the way things went with the lawsuit. So, the Hulk Hogan verdict was in March of 2016. That was essentially the end of Gawker pretty much at that point. And you mentioned Peter Thiel. I'm curious your take on what's come since then, in terms of what we know about Peter Thiel. Interestingly, the reason that we know that Peter Thiel funded
this lawsuit. And I know we tried, you know, Ryan Holiday wrote a book about this. There's lots of lawsuits that he tried to essentially, was because he had been publicly outed, you know, years back, and had harbored this grudge against Gawker, which he felt had sort of unceremoniously, you know, revealed that he was gay, and also that he was a hypocrite because he had, you know, sort of conservative leanings. What do you think of kind of the method that he took, but also like where that stands in kind of some of the other things we talked about, like, you know, in the way that these articles have, you know, an impact on people's lives?
I thought what he did was sociopathically brilliant. I mean, talk about a long game. That was amazing. I was like, wow, that's extremely cinematic what you did. And I almost have to give you credit if you weren't completely evil. Sorry, what was the second half of your question?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that sort of answers it. What did you call it? Psychopathically evil, sociopathically evil, or brilliant, I guess.
Yeah. I was impressed, but it's also, you know, the extent to which Gawker, like a website that at that time was like very New York media focused, you know, had like bloggers still writing for $30 a post, like the extent to which it bothered him is a credit to Gawker.
Yeah. Well, and Gawker's power. I always remember, I mean, this is a little bit different, but Emily Gould in this was, I went back and looked, 2007 was on Larry King when Jimmy Kimmel was guest hosting. And I don't know if you remember this clip, but, you know, he basically, you know, I think it's fair to say by today's parlance was like mansplaining to her about why celebrities have feelings and she should be more aware of, you know, how hurtful you can be to the poor celebrities. It's a stunning thing. I don't think it would have happened today because I think that there would have been at least some level of shame that would have happened before that he would have gone down that road. But even then, I mean, you know, what Gawker was doing had real power, even if it wasn't necessarily like, you know, the readership of the New York Times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you see, like, you know, the celebrity gossip account, Dumois, which is like extremely popular, million plus followers, like basically their entire métier is Gawker stalker. They're like, you know, Kevin Durant spotted at 10th and 8th right now, go see him.
Yeah.
So it's nice to see that never went away.
No, only the backlash to it maybe has at least a little bit subsided.
Right.
But all right, so let's talk about rejoining Gawker and what you're doing now. I was a little critical of things like, was Steve Scalise shot in the dick, which, mm-hmm. you know, not only I thought was, there's not much to the story, but it actually didn't answer whether he was or not. But I have to say, you know, some of the ones we mentioned, the Robert F. Kennedy interview, which was like, you know, I guess here's what I would say. A lot of organizations, I feel like this is a guy who has a book on the New York Times bestseller list. I mean, he has some level of real influence. And most people who are in the media, it's almost like they refuse to talk about, like, let's just pretend he doesn't exist. And then he'll go away and then he won't have any power. And I think we've seen that's absolutely not true. That's just not how things work these days. So the decision to sort of, we'll do an interview with him, you know, like that, what is behind that? And why do you think that one really seemed to resonate for a lot of people?
Well, can we just back up a little bit and talk about how one of the first posts that really bothered you on Gawker was the question of, would you have a tail?
And would you have a tail? Yes.
For some reason, this really set you off, but I still want to know if you would have a tail if you could choose.
No, I don't think I would. I wasn't compelled by anyone who seemed to indicate that they would have a tail. And so I'm going to stick with my
This is Gawker, the highs and the lows. Like, what are they going to say next? Would you have a tail? RFK, like, totally just like cratering himself. So the RFK interview came about literally because the PR person emailed our reporter because they are apparently desperate for coverage.
Yeah, because they are not paying attention because they're a bad PR agent.
Not knowing that our reporter is Tarpley Hit is a genius and for fun reads documents and forms. So in order to prepare for this interview, she was absolutely going to go into every public document posted by his charity. She's going to research everything he had to say and, you know, add in fact check comments to just like, you know, we're not going to let this guy just like spout off his BS without being fact checked. So, I mean, it was clear at the end. He was like, why am I being interviewed by this person? I thought this was like a 20-year-old who was just going to ask me softballs. And she really nailed him. And it was super, super satisfying. And he really kind of lost it.
Yeah. Oh, he did. And that's the thing. And maybe it takes someone who is interested in reading all that background information and, you know, to really dig in. They're, you know, it's someone who clearly is not lazy and doesn't just go and just, you know, take the easy road out. But that I feel like is missing a lot because, like I said, I wonder if you, like, do you think that there is something to the fact that a lot of the media today, whether it's the CNNs of the world and NBCs or even, you know, digital outlets that are more in line with like the Gawker readership, just refuse to even engage with RFK Jr. or his book or his theories on vaccines because they just don't want to do the work that it takes to do it in the right way.
I think that's very possible. I also think like I wouldn't really say a degree of laziness, but kind of a degree of like placidness where it's like, okay, I can just interview this guy and what he says is crazy. And I'll put in a few graphs of, you know, why he might be wrong. And like, that's it. That's the article. And I also noticed like papers are really into fact checking, but there's no combination of like the fact checking and the interview. Like this was clear in like Maggie Haberman reporting where she's like, here's what Trump said, but missing was like kind of the inline, you know, annotations about why what he said was untrue or misleading or stuff like that.
Well, and I also think there's a bias of omission that happens a lot with the media where even the fact checking, I mean, every time you know, the Washington Post lead fact checker or Daniel Dale chooses to what he's going to fact check, he's choosing one thing over another. And a lot of times there are things that like, you know, it just feels good to the readership to see it fact checked, but it's like, everyone knows it's, you know, it's, you're not really serving much of a public service because you're not going much beyond the surface here. So,
right. And especially with COVID, it's like, who knows even what you're reading anywhere. And that's why also the RFK interview was satisfying because it was pretty easy to fact check, like that what he was saying was wrong.
Fourth Watch Lightning Round is coming up, but first, why Leah wants to shine a light on performative wokeness in 2022. The other one I would just mention was National White People Take Black Lives Matter Out of Your Bios Day, which I was surprised it didn't piss more people off. I enjoyed it.
I was too.
You know, maybe it hit a little too close to home with people, a little too, but that is kind of the other side of it. I feel like that's changed a lot from the old Gawker is the rise of not just sort of the social justice movement as a real kind of cultural force, which I think in many ways is good, but the rise of the social justice movement as kind of this performative like identity that people have created for themselves on social media. And I do think that, you know, come 2024, really no matter who runs, but certainly if Trump runs, the ability to make fun of those people, which I think you've sort of gone down that road, that's an interesting path to go that I think will lead to some real dividends.
I mean, I think one thing Brian Goldberg and I agree on is like a distaste of wokeness, like performative wokeness. And hopefully that will, you know, keep him running the site for, or keep him funding the site for a while. But it's nice to kind of pour some vinegar on that where we can. And, you know, everyone on staff is extremely irreverent. It's a diverse staff. So we're coming from all corners of life. And it's just kind of a relief to find each other and be like, oh, like, we agree on this, that, you know, white people who still had BLM in their bios, like, when are they going to take it out? Like, is it just going to be there forever?
Yeah, well, and it gets to the point of like, there's a real difference. And I think that the right makes this mistake a lot between people who are, you know, are woke and who are performing woke, you know, on Twitter, like who are not, you know, what people say, like, do the work. But like, Twitter is such a great magnifier for the sorts of truly like nothingness that people have, you know, when, because it's just so easy to just put something in a bio or to just put something out on Twitter or send a link and it makes you feel good. Mm-hmm. And as opposed to actually, you know, doing something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that's a discourse I'd like to stay out of, or at least make fun of.
Excellent. Well, we're looking out for that. All right. Last thing, 6 questions, 60 seconds. Where were you born?
Park Ridge, Illinois, where Hillary Clinton grew up.
Oh, all right. Fun fact. You're the editor of Gawker. What is one benefit and one cost of that role?
One benefit, I can work at home. One cost, I am always working.
Who's someone who's been a mentor for you?
Probably my boss, Josh Topolsky. We've been together on 2 websites now, and he's taught me a lot on how to build a site that people like to read.
It's also behind the new mic.com, I know. Who's one person you really like professionally or personally that may surprise people?
Ooh. Okay, this is going to sound, I'm going to get reamed for this, but perfect. Working at the opinion page, the best person to work with always was Ross Douthat. Such a nice guy, such a gentleman. He was always like, sorry, I'm like watching my, like, I'm with my kids today, like, I'm a little scattered. So I genuinely liked him, and I don't tend to read him because I'm afraid, but I thought he was a good person.
All right, very good. Who's one person in the media you think's really interesting or talented that isn't getting enough attention?
Interesting. Who works on my staff or who doesn't?
It could be either one.
Probably Kelly Conaboy, who basically invented blogging as it is now, and the rest of the internet likes to imitate her. And when you read the internet, you don't realize that hers is the voice, but it is.
Nice. All right, last one. 1 year from today, what's one prediction for the media?
Oof. I think they'll be in a tailspin again in trying to reclaim their Trump's subscription levels by, I don't know, making up some new enemy.
All right, Leah Finnegan, thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks to Leah Finnegan. That was fun. Remember, Fourth Watch, not just a podcast, it's also a newsletter. Subscribe for free at fourthwatch.media. Join me. Let's build a better media together. If you like the music in the show as I do, check out the artist who created it, Super Duper. That's Super Duper Music on Instagram. The song is Far From Falling. Download it wherever you get your music. And download, follow, like, rate, review this podcast on Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts. Back soon. Stay safe. Talk to you then.